Welcome back to Earth First Radio. We're going to get into animal news here in just a second. All right. Welcome back. Unfortunately, the animal news is not too good today. According to the August 10th Boulder Daily Camera, the ninth of 41 lynx reintroduced into Colorado by state biologists was found dead 2 weeks ago near Folsom, New Mexico. The animal's body was too badly decomposed to determine the cause of death. Todd Malmesbury, spokesman for the Colorado Division of Wildlife, said there was, quote, nothing to indicate that the cat was sickly or starving. Earlier this year, biologists began trapping lynx in Canada and Alaska and setting them free in southwestern Colorado. The rare cats had all but disappeared from the state after decades of trapping and poisoning. Since January, biologists from the Colorado River's Division of Wildlife have released 41 lynx. 5 died of starvation, 2 after being struck by cars, and 1 after being shot, and the latest from unknown causes. 4 of the first 5 cats reintroduced from Colorado died of starvation, prompting biologists to reassess the program's release protocol. Last spring, state officials began holding lynx in pens, nourishing them prior to release. Division staff announced last spring that if more than half of the 29 cats released in May died of starvation, they would consider calling an end to the 3-year reintroduction project. 5 of those 29 cats have now died, only 1 of starvation. In his most recent press release on the lynx, Malmesbury noted that other carnivore reintroduction projects have seen mortality rates of up to 70%. Division biologists will present an update of the lynx reintroduction program to the State Wildlife Commission in Colorado at its September 9th and 10th meeting in Grand Junction. If you'd like agenda information, you can call 303-297-1192. That's 303-297-1192. And from Connecticut, we read, the University of Connecticut and pharmaceutical giant Pfizer are planning to build a research center in the home of several threatened bird species, according to the Hartford Courant of July 29th. Although the state policy office has approved the center, the State Council on Environmental Quality may call for a comprehensive environmental study of the project. The area known as Horse Barn Hill is a breeding or migratory spot for the northern harrier, the horned lark, the American kestrel, the savannah sparrow, and the eastern meadowlark. All species are listed by the state as endangered, threatened, or of special concern. Quote, it is certain, states an April letter to the university planners from state ornithologist Margaret Rubega, that, quote, this is one of the most important sites in the state for a group of birds that is severely threatened on a national scale, and the best available science suggests that building the facility on Horse Barn Hill will adversely affect these populations, unquote. The State Department of Public Health must also approve development of the site, which is considered a Class 2 watershed land. University and Pfizer officials have defended the location, saying the research center would have no significant effect on the birds. Meanwhile, a coalition of opponents filed a lawsuit in state court earlier this month, saying the project would violate environmental laws. And the U.S. Forest Service, seeking to avoid new legal problems in the U.S. District Court, is putting on hold a number of new timber sales in the spotted owl regions of the Northwest, according to Hal Burton of the Oregonian in a newspaper article of August 12th. Last week, District Court Judge William Dwyer ruled the Forest Service had violated the Northwest Forest Plan by failing to carry out numerous wildlife surveys prior to putting timber up for sale. The judge put a restraining order on 9 federal timber sales. The order eventually could be broadened to include other sales in weeks ahead. The ruling was widely viewed as a big setback for the Northwest Forest Plan, forged in 1994 by the Clinton administration to help resolve years of court struggles among conservationist industry and the agencies about logging in the spotted owl forests of the region. The Forest Service's recent decision to stop advertising any new timber sales in the region immediately broadens the effect of the ruling. The agency plans to keep that hold in place until the legal issues can be clarified, according to Rex Holloway, a spokesperson for the Forest Service's regional office in Portland, Oregon. Quote, we need to work this through and figure out what we need to do, Holloway said Wednesday night. The request to put on hold a hold on new timber sales was conveyed by the regional office to the Forest Service supervisors this week. Agency officials hope the legal issues can be resolved in a matter of weeks, but Holloway acknowledged the process could take longer. Judge Dwyer has scheduled another hearing for later this month. U.S. Senator Ron Wyden's office has requested a meeting with Forest Service officials to discuss the effects of the judge's ruling. Wyden staff members say that the meeting is urgently needed to help resolve issues. Dwyer said the government violated the Northwest Forest Plan by failing to properly survey the logging units for dozens of species. His decision came in a lawsuit that 13 conservation groups filed against the agencies last summer. And in energy news, President Clinton will announce a long-term effort today to help replace coal, oil, and natural gas and uranium with farm products, crop waste, and trees to make everything from electricity to pharmaceuticals to fuel, car, and forks. In an executive order, the president will set a goal of working with various industries to triple the amount of energy generated from such projects by 2010. The order, White House officials said, instructs the Secretaries of Agriculture and Energy and the Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency to write plans to coordinate research, create markets, and take other steps to nurture renewable technologies. The administration also plans to develop proposals to research grants, tax credits to promote such technologies. Administration officials predict that developing more uses for agricultural products will result in a $15 to $20 billion of additional farm income by the year 2010 and less use of imported oil. Quote, essentially all of society in the last 100 years is built on petroleum as the energy and raw material, said the participant in the effort, Dr. Robert Dorsch, Director of Biotechnology Development at DuPont. We need to go from black gold to green gold, Dorsch said. DuPont is working on an improved polyester based on natural sugars instead of petroleum and is hoping that with federal research money and coordination, the price of such sugars will fall. Other companies have been working with the government over the last 9 months contend that motor fuel, solvents, and electricity can be made from natural materials known as biomass on a cost-effective basis with a reduction in pollution. The discussions have included major companies in agricultural chemicals, natural gas, and forestry, as well as genetic engineering and other high-tech companies. Quote, we're looking at taking things we currently just throw away, making them profitable, fighting global warming, and cleaning the environment at the same time, said Roger Ballantyne, the Deputy Assistant to the President for Environmental Initiatives. Vice President Al Gore, who stressed federal promotion of new technology as well as environmentalism and support for farmers, said in a telephone interview that the initiative will, quote, help ensure that the agricultural economy is part of the new economy. All right. Some of that sounds good, some of that sounds not so good. Communities could be issued a total of $9.5 billion in zero-cost financing over the next 5 years for environmental projects under a new legislation sponsored by two influential U.S. senators. The bill would cost the U.S. Treasury a total of $700 million in foregone interest payments on so-called community open space bonds between now and 2004, said aides to the bill. Sponsors Max Baucus, a Montana Democrat, and Orrin Hatch, a Utah Republican. Such programs provide localities with zero-rate borrowing because the U.S. government pays investors federal tax credits rather than traditional interest. Localities could use the proceeds to buy green space, protect water quality, clean up and redevelop contaminated brownfield sites, build park facilities, the sponsors said. Baucus is the top Democrat on the State Environment and Public Works Committee, the Senate Environmental and Public Works Committee, and is lined to replace Senator Patrick Moynihan. Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York is the lead Democrat on the pivotal Senate Finance Committee. Hatch is also a member of the Finance Panel, which would have primary jurisdiction over the bill. The bill helps satisfy a huge demand for these types of locally driven projects, a Baucus aide said. Quote, last year, over 200 ballot initiatives set aside more than $7.5 billion over the next 20 years for buying green or open space and protecting groundwater recharge areas, building parks, etc. The tax credit approach slipped in last week as Congress scrambled to tie up loose ends before the August recess is similar to the, quote, Better America Bonds program pushed by the Clinton administration in its fiscal year 2000 proposed budget. Clinton first offered $24 billion of tax credit bonds, which would help localities finance school construction projects in 1997. The scaled-back version landed that year's final year's tax package during 11th-hour negotiations. All right, we're going to go to a commentary. This is from Earth First Radio commentator Oak.
Okay. This first piece is this first commentary for Earth First Radio by your pal Oak is Wooden Al Talks Sprawl. Vice President Al Gore's recent pronouncements on suburban sprawl sent this observer back to the bookshelf, where Gore's book Earth in the Balance maintains a rather tenuous existence. On more than a few occasions, I have entertained the thought of having the paperback shredded and mailing the remains to its author, the man who wrote these words. The integrity of the environment is not just another issue to be used in political gains for popularity, votes, or attention, and the time has long since come to take more political risks and endure much more political criticism by proposing tougher, more effective solutions and fighting hard for their enactment. Well, yeah. This time around, I once again spared Gore's echo tome and ignoble fate in order to search out what thoughts he may have had back in 1992 on the subject of suburban sprawl. Alas, the word sprawl does not appear in the index, nor does the word growth, as in mindless growth. Of course, the environmental community has been addressing this issue for the past 30 years. But, to be fair, Gore's book does point out humanity's increasingly aggressive encroachment into the natural world as an ecological threat. In a chapter on dysfunctional civilization, we are reminded, in general terms, of our society's addiction to overconsumption. And further on, Gore notes, just as totalitarianism collapses individuals into the state, the new ideology of consumption collapses individuals into the desire for what they consume. Well, we couldn't agree more, Al. Now let's actually do something. This, naturally, has always been the gripe with Gore. For all his lofty rhetoric, assuming it's his, he has allowed himself to be hamstrung by a president whose environmental record is abysmal. Where are those political risks? I imagine this talk of sprawl is the first salvo from Al Gore Unchained. We will soon be treated to more talk of this nature as Wooden Al maneuvers towards the next elections. But frankly, I think Al Gore and most everyone inside the Beltway will be talking until they are blue in the face before much of anything gets done. Anyway, it's hard to hear them over the din of all that noisy sprawl. They could remedy that, as you know. Actions speak much louder than words. Anyway, that's the view from this oak for Earth First Radio.
And we want to thank Oak for those commentaries. Let's get back into the news from California. On the dry, dusty lake bed of Owens Lake at the base of the Sierra Nevada, U.S. EPA's Western Regional Administrator Felicia Marcus will give final approval to a historic clean air plan for Owens Valley. Plagued for over half a century by dust storms that create the worst particulate air pollution in California, the plan will end 70 years of conflict between Los Angeles and the Owens Valley residents and protect the health of tens of thousands of people who live in a 300-mile swath across eastern California and Nevada. The plan is for the city of Los Angeles to pay for covering up the dry lake bed with either water, gravel, or vegetation, and they'll start out with 10 square miles and add a couple of square miles every year. If you'd like further information, contact Randy Wittorp, W-I-T-T-O-R-P, his number, 415-744-1589, or Leo K. at 415-744-2201. Both those folks are with the Environmental Protection Agency, or you can try their webpage at www.epa.gov. And the Monterey Bay chapter of the California Native Plant Society last week petitioned the California State Fish and Game Commission to list the Monterey pine tree as an endangered species. This news from the San Jose Mercury News on August 11th. Quote, people say this tree is so common it's everywhere, said Marianne Matthews, the conservation chair for the chapter. Yet half of the historic population of the species has disappeared because of development and habitat fragmentation. If all the developments proposed or already approved on the Monterey Peninsula are built, the petition states, it would eliminate 50,000 Monterey pine trees and result in the loss or alteration of more than 500 acres of pine forest ecosystem. The remaining trees are threatened by a disease known as pitch canker, which Matthew called incurable and inexorable. The fungal disease carried by insects is expected to kill at least 85% of the trees over the next 20 years. Native Monterey pines grow only in three places in the United States: the Monterey Peninsula, Año Nuevo in Santa Cruz County, and Cambria, and on two small islands in Baja California, Cedros Island and Guadalupe Island. While they used to cover 23,694 acres, according to the petition sent to the commission, native trees now grow only on 13,575 acres. The process of listing the tree as threatened is likely to take more than a year if the petition is found to be complete. The bottom line is that these trees are in deep, serious trouble, said Deborah Hilliard, plant ecologist for the California Department of Fish and Game. And in other California news, the future of three of California's national forests may have been decided this week at a private dinner convened at Lake Tahoe by Senator Dianne Feinstein. The meeting appears to have persuaded the U.S. Forest Service to choose a plan that will more than double logging on 2.5 million acres in the Lassen, Plumas, and Tahoe National Forests, instead of a plan that would allow a much smaller logging increase. The decision, expected to be announced shortly, adheres closely to the wishes of the Quincy Library Group, an ad hoc organization of Plumas County residents that supports the increased logging as a way to keep local timber mills operating while also protecting fish and wildlife. While Feinstein championed the group's efforts by drafting a law along with Representative Wally Herger of Yuba City that authorizes funding for their plan, local interests hailed the plan as a model of cooperation between environmentalists and timber interests, and rural grassroots groups throughout the West have embraced it as a prototype for rural community self-determination. But national environmental groups say the library group's plan is a recipe for disaster, one that will doom imperiled species such as the California spotted owl, the fisher, and the marten. And further, they say the plan and the federal law that it induced, the 1998 Herger-Feinstein Forestry Recovery Act, would set a dangerous precedent. Oh, boy. Moving to Oregon, news from the Eagle Timber Sale. They're very close to victory on the Mount Hood National Forest Eager Timber Sales. Representatives from the offices of Senator Ron Wyden, Representative Earl Blumenauer, and Representative David Wu will be meeting with the Mount Hood Forest Supervisor Gary Larson on August 24th to discuss canceling the sale. This week is critical. We need all the parties involved in this meeting to hear from the public. Your phone calls will really help decide the fate of this beautiful, never-been-cut native forest, which serves as a municipal watershed for 175,000 people. A two-year-long direct action campaign has kept the chainsaws out of two-thirds of the forest. Call Ron Wyden, Senator from Oregon, 503-326-7525. That's 503-326-7525. Earl Blumenauer, 503-231-2300. 503-231-2300. And Representative David Wu, 503-326-2901. That's 503-326-2901. And the Forest Service Supervisor, Gary Larson. Again, his number is 503-668-1700. 503-668-1700. And we thank Andy Davis of the Cascadia Forest Alliance for that news. Also in Oregon, the Siskiyou National Forest Supervisor Mike Lunn announced August 13th the release of the final environmental impact statement and decision on the proposed Nicor mine. The proposed nickel laterite mine is in the Rough and Ready Creek watershed and the South Calmeopsis roadless area. This wild botanically unique landscape is located in southwest Oregon's Siskiyou Mountains, adjacent to the Calmeopsis wilderness. The South Calmeopsis is at over 100,000 acres, is one of the largest unprotected roadless areas in the Northwest. And you should have gotten your federal environmental impact statement and final environmental impact statement and decision by now. If you'd like further information about the Nicor Mine final environmental impact statement, contact Barbara Ullian, Ullian, Conservation Siskiyou Project, P.O. Box 1877, Grants Pass, Oregon 97528. Once again, that's Barbara at the Siskiyou Project, P.O. Box 1877, Grants Pass, Oregon 97528, or Barbara at siskiyou.org. And you spell Siskiyou, S-I-S-K-I-Y-O-U. Once again, that's Barbara at Siskiyou.org. And from Oregon, we've got the Bark Alert. They're talking about the Slinky Project area. This is a Mount Hood timber sale. Where is it? It's in the Clackamas District of the Mount Hood National Forest. The units are the Kink and Harriet Lake sub-drainage of the Oak Grove watershed and the Switch Creek sub-watershed of the Upper Clackamas. The area is heavily cut and fragmented, 195 acres, 8 million board feet, 7/10 of a mile of road, and it's in the matrix, Northwest Forest Plan matrix. If you'd like to comment on this, contact Jerry Polzin, P-O-L-Z-I-N, at 503-630-6861. Once again, that's Jerry at 503-630-6861. And the Forest Service contact is Christine Pazula, P-A-Z-Z-U-L-A, Acting District Ranger, Clackamas River Ranger District, 595 Northwest Industrial Way, Estacada, Oregon, E-S-T-A-C-A-D-A, at 97023. Once again, that's Christine Pazula, Acting District Ranger, Clackamas River Ranger District, 595 Northwest Industrial Way, Estacada, Oregon, 97023. Oh boy. 190 acres of clear cut and 5 acres of thinning. What's the problem here? Well, logging these remaining mature forests will create massive areas on the Oak Grove Butte ridgeline that are all, there's all kinds of stuff going on. Real problems. Contact them. Here's news from Arizona. Forest Service Conservation Council and the National Forest Protection Alliance were joined by Forest Guardians, Flagstaff Activist Network, the John Muir Project, the Lands Council, and the Native Forest Council to win a significant administrative appeal on August 3rd of a 1,700-acre Fort Valley Restoration Project near Flagstaff, a project jointly planned by the U.S. Forest Service and Grand Canyon Forest Partnership. And so that's a good deal. The Forest Service concluded that effects to cultural resources had not been documented and that actions may be reasonably foreseeable had not been addressed in the cumulative effects analysis. The appeal victory is one of the first by the National Forest Protection Alliance and sends a strong message to both the collaboration and restoration logging camps. The Forest Service had argued in its record of decision that all the interested stakeholders had been involved, but in fact of the matter is that there was significant dissent as evidenced by this appeal. The appeal puts the brakes on restoration logging efforts that have been embraced by several regional organizations. And Arizona and New Mexico environmentalists are urging a halt to the cutting of large old ponderosa pines north of the Grand Canyon. Let's move to Florida. A Florida man gets the longest term in environment case and the longest sentence meted out by the federal government in an environmental crimes case. A Florida man was sentenced on Monday to 13 years in prison for dumping toxic waste into Tampa, Florida's sewer system and waterways, according to the Justice Department. Well, that's about it for the news. To get news, announcements, or comments from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, why don't you send us some email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's it, folks. cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief@cruzio.com. Or send those letters, donations, CDs, cassettes, whatever you want to get to Uncle Dennis, send it to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please, please, please send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. I hate reading things that have already, about reading things that have already happened. Doesn't help you out either. For more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That's Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And Earth First Radio is broadcast live on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Or you can listen to Earth First Radio anytime on your computer on the World Wide Web. point your browser to radioforall.web.net. That's https://radioforall.web.net. That is the number 4 in there. You'll need a sound card, but the software you need is downloadable free from the website. A lot of people listen that way, too. Earth First Radio is being rebroadcast on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. If you found us on the web, ask your local station to download and rebroadcast Earth First Radio for all the folks in town. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. Earth First Radio is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening, and please tune in again. And we're going to listen to some poetry. Or no, actually, we're going to be listening to some flute music. We already listened to the poetry. We're going to be listening to some flute music here. And this is a guy I met at the Round River Rendezvous. He played at the rally at the Round River Rendezvous. His name is John Ginther. And John plays the flute. And really did a really fine job at the Rendezvous. Unfortunately, the recording that I made at the Rendezvous wasn't very good, but John was very helpful, gave me a copy of his cassette called Eagle Heart, and I wanted to play a selection off of that. He's got about 6 selections off of here. We're going to try and play some more of these in future Earth First Radio shows, but I thought this stuff was real pretty, and hopefully John Ginther will be around for more Rendezvous, and folks can check him out. Anyway, you can contact John Ginther at P.O. Box 2027 Del Norte, Colorado, 81132. That's John Ginther, Box 2027 Del Norte, Colorado, 81132. All right. Here's a song from John called The Greeting Song.